Well, welcome back to our introduction to American law. This is lesson number 4, which we're recording on April 6, 2020. And this part of the program, we're going to be covering the subject of civil procedure. And in our text, we'll be covering pages 95 to 139. Civil procedure. What is that? Well, you know what it is. I don't know if I would have independently been able to come up with a definition of it, but the author, I think, did a pretty good job. Civil procedure is simply the body of law that structures the mechanism of litigation. It tells us how we sue people and how we get sued. Tell us what happens during that process. Well, what is litigation? Suing people, we kind of know that, but again, I think the author came up with a pretty good definition of the word litigation, and that is the process of authoritative dispute resolution by the government. So in other words, there are disputes between people. One way of settling them and settling them for good, hopefully, is through through our government, namely our courts. So it's a process of authoritative dispute resolution by the government. Before he jumps into the actual discussion of the subject matter, the author makes 4 important points about litigation. First of all, litigation is a very rare event. Most disputes are solved without litigation. A couple of weeks ago, I'm recording this during the coronavirus epidemic, and during one of the first days of that, when I was cloistered in, going to pick up my groceries at Walmart, another car backed into me and left a dent in my car. In better times, probably would have tried to resolve that event, but I got out and I looked at the car. We exchanged insurance information just in case something big had happened, There was a pretty good sized dent in my car, but not that big, and it was a 12-year-old car. I think I finally just decided, you know what, it's just not worth it. I'm just gonna forget about it. There's just one more dent on an old car, not that big a deal. We're not gonna get anywhere even close to the process of litigation. So that's the first point. Litigation is a very rare event, and very rarely are cases actually litigated. Even if I had a slam dunk liability case against this other person, for whatever reason, it just wasn't worth it. The other thing the author points out in our American system, in our common law system, really, in most of the English-speaking world, it's an adversary process. The process is dictated by the parties. The parties, the plaintiff and defendant, pretty much control what's going to happen. Now, the court, especially more and more so over the years, the court gets involved and sets deadlines and says when things are going to happen. But in general, things don't happen in the litigation process unless one of the parties asks for it to happen. One thing that's surprising to even to attorneys and especially non-attorneys in other states is kind of a unique twist in Minnesota litigation, just to show how much the process is dictated by the parties. The Minnesota Rules of Civil Procedure say that a lawsuit is commenced upon service of the complaint. That makes sense. And most of the times when attorneys read that, they think in terms of, we have to make sure that we commence this lawsuit before the statute of limitations runs out. So the key part of timekeeping is when the complaint is served upon the other party. And that's one thing that rule does. But the other thing that rule does, it means that lawsuits are taking place without really any court involvement. It's just strictly the attorneys who are involved in it. So if I prepare a summons and complaint and serve it upon you, Well, you have been sued at that point, and the lawsuit has been commenced under Minnesota law. Notice I didn't say anything about taking a copy of that complaint down to the courthouse. And in fact, maybe I will never take a copy of the complaint down to the courthouse. But I have served you, and that lawsuit has begun. And you are required to provide an answer. Otherwise, you will be in default. And at that point, I can, my first visit to the court will be to ask for the default judgment. If you do answer, we can conduct the discovery, quite possibly even settle the case without it ever being filed with the court. So the only time it would have to be filed with the court is if either I as the plaintiff's attorney or you as the defendant's attorney, decided that, you had to file a motion of some kind. You wanted to have the case dismissed. Well, if I commence this lawsuit and you, the defendant, are the one who makes the first trip down to the courthouse to file the case, to say that, we want to have this case dismissed. So in Minnesota, that's kind of an extreme. I don't think that's the case in most other states. Most other states, you do have to file a copy of the complaint, with the court, as part of the process of starting the litigation, and certainly in the federal system, you have to do that. But in the state of Minnesota, state cases can work their way to completion as long as that completion is not a trial. But the litigation can drag on for years without the case getting a court file number. So that just shows how much that the adversary process in our common law system is dictated by the parties. It's not dictated by the court imposing, here's what's going to happen next in this litigation. The whole point of litigation, the author points out, and his third point, is that it involves fact-finding and applying the law. That's what litigation is. The litigation is designed to figure out what happened, finding the facts, and then based upon what happened, applying the proper law, saying that when this situation happens, this is the law that needs to be applied. So that's what litigation is. It is fact finding and applying of the law to those facts. The author points out that civil litigation, civil procedure, is not the only form of dispute resolution, and in a sense the criminal law system is a system of dispute resolution. So if you steal something from me, I'm probably not going to bring a civil lawsuit against you, because the kind of people who steal things are often judgment proof. But what I certainly will do is call the cops, and with the hope of having you arrested and tossed in jail. And perhaps I'll get some restitution out of that process. But even if I don't, I guess I would feel in some ways that my dispute has been resolved by the virtue of the fact that you've been tossed in jail. And then, of course, that form of dispute resolution, the criminal system, it's not governed quite so much by the parties. It's governed by the parties in the sense of the state being one of the parties, and the defendant. There's still that adversary system, meaning that the parties kind of figure out what's going to happen in the case more so than the judge. But it is a different form of dispute resolution, the criminal system, as opposed to our body of civil procedure. And finally, the last point the author makes is that, I guess this makes it 5 points, the litigation is governed by the law of civil procedure, which is what this lesson, this chapter, are all about. So litigation. When you say litigation to a member of the public, chances are you're going to hear something about, Americans are too litigious, or these lawyers are just bringing way too many lawsuits. Their complaints about the litigiousness. So we need to do something to crack down on litigation. But the author points out that when those complaints arise, it's usually, if you dig a little bit deeper, the complaint is not so much that the people are too litigious. It usually boils down to a complaint more about the substantive law. that the law is set so that it's possible for people to be very litigious for what is sometimes perceived as trivial situations. But what we're talking about in this chapter is not the substantive law that honestly is probably the source of those complaints more than anything, but the actual litigation process and civil procedure. Why do we have litigation? We have litigation because there are some problems that people can't solve by themselves. So if your fence is encroaching on my property line, we can talk about it all day, but eventually we just can't come to a resolution. So we have to figure out some system of resolving problems that we can't solve ourselves, which might be the litigation process, which might be some form of alternative dispute resolution. Maybe we can at least settle on that. We can settle on the fact that we'll have this third person decide the case for us. But if we can't decide on that, we have this body of law called civil procedure that allows us to settle those disputes as kind of a last resort. There are other ways of doing it because some people, for example, do not have recourse to the civil litigation system. And the example given by the author is drug dealers. If I sell you some illegal drugs and you don't pay me for them, well, that's kind of a problem. Now, if I sold you a container load of widgets and you didn't pay for them, well, that's why we have courts. I would take you to court. I would get a judgment against you for the purchase price of the car load of widgets, and the system runs smoothly because ultimately I know that you will probably pay because you know that if you don't pay, I'm going to take you to court. But some people don't have that recourse. That works fine if I'm selling you widgets, but probably doesn't work quite so well if I'm selling you illegal drugs because I can't go to court. Because the substantive law usually says that you can't go to court to sue for an illegal contract. So if you're a drug dealer, you have to be a little bit more creative, and you have to come up with alternative methods of dispute resolution, namely violence. So the black markets are useful in showing us what can happen if we don't have the rule of law, because I guess I would rather live in a society where people are getting sued for not paying for their widgets because that's a pretty orderly system. Whereas if we have disputes that have to be settled through violence, even if I'm not a party to that transaction, at least I'm going to get caught in the fallout of that. So that's why the author points out that why do we have litigation? Because a well-ordered society wants some kind of a mechanism to resolve our differences. That system has to be fair. More importantly, than being fair, it has to be perceived as fair, because if I'm selling my perfectly legal widgets and you don't pay for them, but then I think, well, the court system in this state is just stacked against me. There's no way that I'm going to get a fair treatment if I sue you for the cost of the widgets. Well, in that case, if I believe that, even if it's not true, well, then I'm not going to resort to the court system. I'm going to resort to violence to collect the money that I think is mine. So the system has to be fair. The system has to be perceived as fair, and it has to be efficient, too. So you can't, you don't necessarily get perfect justice, but you need to have efficient justice because, if I spend $1 million to try to collect the cost of my 1,000 widgets, that's not going to work too well. So the system has to be fair, it has to be perceived as fair, and it has to be efficient. Those are the kind of the guiding principles of the law of civil procedure. The author already pointed out that litigation is a rare event because before a case has to be litigated, there are a number of ancillary steps. First of all, the victim has to recognize that there's a potential lawsuit. So if I if something bad happens to me, either I don't know that something bad happened to me, you know, my car is parked, somebody backs into it and dents it, and I don't notice it because it's such a small dent. Well, if I had noticed the dent, I guess I could have gone after the person for it. But if I don't even know that I have an injury, that's kind of the first level of screening. I have to recognize that there's a law that protects me in that case. I have to recognize that I have a potential lawsuit, and I have to recognize that I have something to be gained. So again, the case of the person who backed into my car at the Walmart parking lot. I recognized that I had something to gain by pursuing it, but the amount that I stood to gain kind of paled in comparison to the added stress that it would bring not only to my life but to the other person's life by pursuing the matter. It just wasn't worth it. I didn't recognize that I had something to be gained about it. There's a second step. For most people, is the ability to obtain a lawyer, because to navigate this civil litigation system, in most cases, you really need a lawyer. Perhaps you can take somebody to small claims court without an attorney, but even there, it might be a good idea to get some guidance from a lawyer before you go to make sure that you have a case. Certainly for a larger case, as a practical matter, you need you need an attorney, and that ability to obtain a lawyer might be the thing that that weeds out some piece of litigation. Okay, so we've decided that we do have a case, and we decided that it's worth pursuing. So the first question is, where do we bring the lawsuit? We know that there are these entities called courts, and we know that there are courts out there, but the question is, which court do we go to? So in other words, those of us who are lawyers realize that what we're talking about right now is jurisdiction. What court has jurisdiction over this case? And the word jurisdiction, if you break that down, juris means law and diction means talking. You have to find the court that speaks the right law. You have to find the court with the correct jurisdiction, because there are many courts out there. There is a court in every county in the state of Minnesota. There are different courts in every county in Minnesota. There's the district court. There's the small claims court. There's the family court. There's the probate court. So there are different courts. There's one of those in each county. There's the federal court. There's the Court of Appeals. There's the Supreme Court. Each of these courts has a particular job. In many cases, they overlap. Sometimes I have choice of more than one court where I can bring the case. But we have to know what court to go to. What court has jurisdiction? The word jurisdiction is really just a fancy legal word for what court do I go to? The jurisdiction is actually broken down in two ways. There is subject matter jurisdiction. So in other words, the kind of case. The probate court does not have any jurisdiction over a personal injury case. So if I get hit by a car and I stumble into the probate court and I say, I want to file my lawsuit here, well, they'll say, no, you're in the wrong place. This court doesn't have jurisdiction over that kind of thing. So a lot of times it's very easy like that, because it says right on the door what their subject matter jurisdiction is. Other cases, it gets a little bit more difficult, of course, which is why you spent a whole year in law school studying civil procedure. In general, subject matter jurisdiction just means the court that handles this kind of case. So what court has subject matter jurisdiction if I have to sue somebody for injuries I sustained in a car accident? Well, probably if that accident happened in Ramsey County, Minnesota, well, where which it did. I was in a car accident in Ramsey County, Minnesota. So if I wanted to sue the person who backed into my car, a court in Ramsey County, Minnesota would have jurisdiction. And in that particular case, it would be the district court, because the district court is in Minnesota the court of general jurisdiction. So if it's not some specific subject matter, like the probate court, kind of the district court is the catch-all court in Minnesota. Some states that's called the Superior Court, might be called other things. But I can probably file it in two different courts. More than one court might have subject matter jurisdiction. That was a pretty small dent in my car, so I was probably within the jurisdictional limit of the small claims court. Well, yes, and you already know that that's actually just a branch of the district court. But let's for now let's pretend it's two separate courts. So I have the option of filing it in the court of general jurisdiction, or I ha also had the choice of filing it in the specialized court, the court set aside for small cases under whatever dollar amount. I think it's $5,000 or something, where kind of a different set of procedures apply. Let's say the driver was a resident of Hennepin County. Well, I could probably sue the person in Hennepin County also. That court would also have subject matter jurisdiction. But subject matter jurisdiction answers the question of what court handles this kind of case. And the author doesn't talk about, but it's broken down a little bit more into venue. Which is specifically which county in the state. For now, I'm just kind of lumping them all together as being a subject matter jurisdiction. So that's subject matter jurisdiction. What kind of case? Auto accidents in the state is the subject, and this court takes that kind of case. The other matter is personal jurisdiction. That answers the question not of the kind of case, but the kind of defendant. And whether a court has personal jurisdiction answers the question, does this court have authority over that particular defendant, over that particular person, to order them to come into court and litigate this case, and or pay any judgment if necessary? Can they exercise jurisdiction over that person? So those are the two issues, and we're going to talk in a little bit more detail about both of them as we go on. The example, if you've been reading the text, the author talks about this auto using as kind of an example case for a lot of different points. He's talking about this auto accident that took place in Oklahoma by some New York residents who happened to be driving through Oklahoma and got into a car accident. And the author discusses the various things that happened to these non-hypothetical people. They're not hypothetical people because they were real people, because I'm sure the astute lawyer realized that, wait a minute, they're talking about the worldwide Volkswagen case. So sure enough, yeah, a U.S. Supreme Court case called the Worldwide Volkswagen case from 1980. We'll talk about that in a little bit more detail, what that case actually held. But the author kind of uses this car accident in Oklahoma to talk about a lot of things, in addition to the jurisdictional issues. So anyway, these people got into an auto accident that wasn't their fault. It was somebody else's fault, and they did it in Oklahoma, and they realized they had an injury. They found a lawyer to represent them, so they got through those first screening steps that we talked about previously, and they decided to sue. They're going to sue somebody. So they have to find the right court that has subject matter jurisdiction, and they have to find a court with personal jurisdiction. So the subject matter jurisdiction is pretty easy, because they do have a choice. They have a choice of a number of different courts, but one of them was the state court in Oklahoma. because they got into a car accident in Oklahoma. Well, they went to the court of general jurisdiction in Oklahoma. I don't know what it's called there, probably called a district court or something. And they decided to file their lawsuit there. Perfectly fine. Really no question whatsoever that that was the proper thing to do, because that court certainly has subject matter jurisdiction over automobile accident cases that you know, that arise in that state. So really no question of subject matter jurisdiction. But then there's the other question of, well, so that's where they decided to file it. But the question came up, and as we know, it made it all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, of, well, wait a minute, does this court have personal jurisdiction over the defendants who are going to be litigating this case? And there it got a little bit more complicated, because who were they suing? Well, they were suing the people who crashed into them. So, and it was, you know, it was like, you know, it was like 101% the other person's fault. So, you know, it was this bad accident caused by this other defendant. So does the Oklahoma court have personal jurisdiction over somebody who crashed into them in Oklahoma? And clearly they do. Because they, and that's pretty well settled, that yes, courts have jurisdiction over people who are in the state and do something that they can get sued for. That's why we have courts. So that's pretty clearly settled. They could have chosen, though. I believe this person was not an Oklahoma resident. They were actually a Texas resident. So they could have sued this person in Texas as well, probably, because those courts have personal jurisdiction. Now, there might have been a question about subject matter jurisdiction in that case, but certainly a court in a state where you live has personal jurisdiction over you. So that's good. But as you can tell by the title of the case, they weren't just suing the people that crashed into them. They were suing a bunch of other people. They were suing the makers of Volkswagen. Which was not a company called Worldwide Volkswagen, by the way. They were suing the manufacturer of the Volkswagen car that they were in, because they thought it was not safe enough to withstand this this crash. So that was one of the defendants, and there really wasn't a problem there either, suing the manufacturer of Volkswagens, because they sold Volkswagens in Oklahoma, and they knew that their cars were going to wind up in Oklahoma, and they knew that possibly. They might get sued someday in Oklahoma if something goes wrong with one of their cars. But the other defendant that they decided to include was the car dealer that they bought the car from. And that was a company called Worldwide Volkswagen. So that's always confusing in that case. The company called Worldwide Volkswagen is actually the local dealer in New York. So they're suing a New York car dealer, and because they were from New York, they bought the car in New York. So Worldwide Volkswagen came in and said, "Well, wait a minute. Yeah, there's subject matter jurisdiction in the Oklahoma courts, but you don't have personal jurisdiction over us. We've never been to Oklahoma. We don't have any connection whatsoever with the state of Oklahoma. We are based in New York. We are a New York business. Maybe if somebody sued us in New Jersey, that would be a different matter, because, you know, we sometimes sell cars to people in New Jersey, but we don't sell cars to people in Oklahoma, so that you don't have personal jurisdiction over us. Anyway, that case went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court agreed with Worldwide Volkswagen that no, the courts in Oklahoma did not have personal jurisdiction over that defendant, even though it very properly had subject matter jurisdiction over that kind of case. And they cited a case, again, you remember from your days of civil procedure in law school, the International Shoe case from 1945. The International Shoe Case and the Worldwide Volkswagen Case hold that to decide whether or not a state has personal jurisdiction over a person, whether a court has personal jurisdiction, it has to be such that it doesn't offend our traditional notions of fair play and substantive justice. So in the case of, a New York based car dealer getting sued in Oklahoma, that kind of offends our traditional notions of fair play and substantial justice. It just ain't fair that if you're a New York car dealer that you might get sued in Oklahoma. So therefore, the holding is that the Oklahoma court does not have personal jurisdiction over you. Just kind of as an interesting aside, why, for heaven's sake, were they so concerned about having the Worldwide Volkswagen Company be a party to the case? The reason why was the plaintiffs wanted to make sure, the plaintiffs are from New York, they wanted to make sure that they had at least one other New York defendant in the case. Because if you have one New York plaintiff and one New York defendant, then the federal courts do not have subject matter jurisdiction, because federal courts have subject matter jurisdiction in cases like that only in the case of diversity of citizenship. Federal courts have jurisdiction, among other things, for cases between citizens of different states. If you do not have complete diversity, as they say, if you have one plaintiff from a given state and another and a defendant from that same state, well, then you don't have complete diversity, and it's the federal courts in any part of the country do not have subject matter jurisdiction over that kind of case. And this was at a time when the county where they filed the case in Oklahoma was the best county in the country for plaintiffs in personal injury cases. And if there had been diversity in the case, if it had been between citizens of different states, well, then the defendants could have had the case removed to federal court. And it wouldn't be in that county. It would probably be in Oklahoma City or something, with a federal jury. And the plaintiffs didn't think things were going to go quite so well. So they really wanted to keep it in state court. So that's why they included the Worldwide Volkswagen Company as one of the defendants. Ultimately, the case wound up getting kicked into federal court, where they didn't do quite so well, because they said, no, you can't have Worldwide Volkswagen be a defendant in Oklahoma court, because that offends our traditional notions of fair play and substantial justice, as held by the International Shoe Company. And interestingly, International Shoe was also not really an international company. When they got to court, they were arguing how small they were, and they shouldn't be subject to jurisdiction in a lot of places because they were such a small company, even though they were named International Shoe. So anyway, at this point, we'll give you our first code number for this portion of the program, and that is 4-164. 4-164. 4-164 is the first code number for this part of the program. The next subject the author turns to is, I want to make this a federal case. You know that saying, don't make a federal case out of it. How do you make something a federal case? We have two separate layers of court systems in this country. We have our state courts, that I just mentioned. In Minnesota, it's called the district court. In a lot of court cases, it's called the superior court. Most countries, that would be it. You have a court system. In this country, we have another layer of court system called the federal courts. But the federal courts are courts of limited jurisdiction. You can't just turn anything into a federal case. There are only certain cases that the federal courts hear. Well, why do we have federal courts? Well, when the Constitution was formed, first of all, there was a recognition that there will be some national issues. And if you have national issues, you want national courts. deciding those issues. You don't want the, you know, you don't want the small claims court in Minnesota, you know, ruling that the IRS can't collect taxes or something. So you want national courts to address these national issues. And there was also a feeling that we want to make sure that out-of-staters are protected from parochial interests. So, again, if you're a New York car dealer, suddenly you wind up in court in Oklahoma, well, maybe that's not going to be, maybe they're going to be a little bit more parochial and rule against you because you're an out-of-stater. So having this national court system was believed to be able to protect against those parochial interests a little bit better. In general, there are two areas where federal courts have subject matter jurisdiction. And there are a few others. This is not an exclusive list. So, for example, they talked about admiralty cases, cases where the United States is a party, etc. We're not really going to go into those too much. But the two that we worry about the most, and you spent many grueling hours in law school learning about, first of all, federal question jurisdiction and diversity jurisdiction. So federal question jurisdiction is cases arising under the Constitution or arising under the laws of the United States. So if there's a federal law saying you can sue, you know, if this happens to you, well, then that's pretty clearly a federal question. And you can bring your lawsuit based upon that federal question. Or if you think somebody is trampling over your First Amendment rights, well, that's the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. So that's a federal question. You have this case because of the U.S. Constitution. Your case arises under the Constitution. It has to really arise under it. For example, it can't... You can't say, well, there might be a defense under the Constitution. No, the case has to arise under federal law. So that's one category where federal courts have their limited jurisdiction. The other case is that federal courts have subject matter jurisdiction over diversity cases. The federal court has subject matter jurisdiction over cases between citizens of different states. So if I you get into a car accident with me, and I am a Minnesota resident and you are a Wisconsin resident, well, I can go to federal court because you know, it's just a plain old car accident, but there's diversity jurisdiction. So if I want to, I can sue you in federal court. I can make it a federal case because it's a case between citizens of different states. In general, that's my choice. I get to decide. I'm the plaintiff. I decide whether I'm going to sue you in state court. I decide if we're going to sue in federal court. That's generally my choice. But remember, part of the reason why we have this is to protect against parochial interests. So you're an out-of-stater, I sue you in Minnesota state court. Well, you don't think you're going to get a fair shake in Minnesota state court because of our Minnesota parochial interests. Well, you as a defendant can make that option to go to federal court. You can have the case removed to federal court. And there's a procedure for doing that. You can say, no, I don't want to be in state court in Minnesota. I want to be in the federal court in Minnesota because I think I'll get a fairer shake there. So that's why we have federal courts in addition to those miscellaneous things like admiralty. One day I was at a CLE program. You probably, if you're in Minnesota, we don't have too many admiralty cases, nor do we in Iowa and Wisconsin, where most of my, people who take my classes are from. I did once meet an Iowa admiralty attorney. Because he was retained in some litigation involving the sale of a ship, that there was a dispute of, you know, somebody sold a ship to somebody else and they hadn't gotten paid for it. It was moving from the, uh, from the East Coast to the West Coast, or vice versa. But anyway, it was passing through Iowa on a on Interstate 80 on a semi truck. So he was retained as an Iowa Admiralty attorney to arrest this vessel as it sailed through the state of Iowa. So that was a federal case because the federal courts have admiralty jurisdiction. So he brought a lawsuit in the federal district court in Iowa in a rare exercise of their admiralty jurisdiction. So the federal courts have a few miscellaneous things like that, like patents, for example. But in general, it comes up in two ways, federal question jurisdiction or diversity jurisdiction. Generally, if there's a choice in those diversity cases, the plaintiff gets to make that choice, but the defendant can remove the case to federal court. Well, sometimes on these multi-state things, you as a Wisconsin resident get into a car accident with me, a Minnesota resident, you say, well, the Wisconsin law says I was okay because if I make a left turn in this situation, I have the right of way or whatever, and the Minnesota law is different. Well, which law applies? That's kind of an important thing. So you come in with your Wisconsin driver's manual and say, I was in the right. Look, right here it says I was allowed to do the thing I was doing. And I come in court with my Minnesota driver's manual and say, no, in Minnesota, the chapter 169 of the Minnesota statute says I was in the right. So occasionally there will be a situation like that of what is called a conflict of law. And the court has to figure out which state's law applies in this given situation. That's a one semester course in law schools of conflicts of law. One of the hardest classes for a lot of students, I know. So we'll give you the 5-minute summary of it. So they actually go a lot deeper than this. But first of all, the state applies its own procedural law. So if there are procedural things about the civil procedure, and whatever court happens to be hearing the case will apply its own procedural law. So the state of Minnesota has the Minnesota Rules of Civil Procedure. So if we're in the Minnesota court, those are the procedural rules we will follow. If we are in Wisconsin, then we'll follow the Wisconsin rules of civil procedure. And you remember from civil procedure class the Erie Doctrine. Remember the Erie case? And that said that if we're in federal court, the federal court is going to apply its own set of procedures, namely the federal rules of civil procedure. If we're in federal court, that court, again under the Erie Doctrine, will apply its own state substantive law. So in general, if we're even though we're in federal court because we had diversity jurisdiction or whatever, the court is going to be applying Minnesota law or whatever court whatever law the state courts in that state would apply. But sometimes, like that complicated case where you have one set of laws in your favor and I have one set of laws in my favor, we have to figure out which set of those apply. And again, this would be a whole one semester conflicts of law. But in general and kind of originally, you apply the law of the state where the case arose. So in the case of that car accident, we would probably go with Minnesota law if it was an accident that took place in Minnesota, or we would go with Wisconsin law if it was an accident that took place in Wisconsin. Now, that might be a little bit more complicated than that, because like I say, that's why they have a whole semester digging deep into that issue. But in general, it's probably still true to say that in the vast majority of cases, you're going to apply the law of the state where the case arose. So if you get into an accident with me in Minnesota, and I decide to sue you in Wisconsin state court, well, that's perfectly fine because you're a resident of Wisconsin and you don't really have any complaints about that. But since the accident took place in Minnesota and there was a difference in the law between the two states, the Wisconsin court would be looking at Minnesota law. So the Wisconsin judge would have to dig out a copy of the Minnesota statutes to figure out what the ruling principle was in that case, because the court would apply the substantive law of the place where the accident or where the case arose, or in this case where the accident took place. Okay, how does the litigation procedure work? Well, if you were in law school, you spent a whole semester or a whole year talking about this. I'll give you kind of the 10-minute version. If we got through all those intermediate steps, I recognize that I have a case that I want to bring, I find a lawyer to help me do that, and we decide we're going to litigate this. The starting place is the plaintiff prepares a complaint. That complaint does a few things. First of all, it has to show the basis of the jurisdiction. So it's just 5 or 6 typewritten pages. One of those paragraphs say, this court has subject matter jurisdiction because it's a traffic accident that took place in this state. It has personal jurisdiction because the defendant is a resident of this state. So it sets forth the basis of the court's subject matter jurisdiction and personal jurisdiction. It notifies the defendant. That's the document that tells the defendant, oh, goody, you're getting sued. So that's that notification. And it states the facts, why I think I'm entitled to money from you, and the legal basis for that claim. So again, the rules of civil procedure in most states just say that the complaint has to be kind of a common sense document, just clearly stating what the basis is for that. It's accompanied by a document called the summons, which says you as a defendant are hereby ordered to comply with, defending yourself against these accusations here. So the plaintiff's attorney prepares the complaint. Now, in most states, we would just say, and then they file the complaint with the court. And then we would also say, and then you have to serve the papers on the other side, which is usually means hiring a process server to physically hand the papers to somebody saying, you are being sued. You want to read these important papers very carefully. And of course, there are other ways to make service of process. If it's a corporation, they probably have a department set aside for that. In many cases, it can, with their consent, it can be done by mail and so forth. But ultimately, you have to get a physical copy of that complaint into the defendant's hands. In Minnesota, that's really the only thing that you have to do to get the process rolling. As I mentioned before, kind of surprising to lawyers in other states, Minnesota does not require you to file it with the court. So the case might go on for years without the court even being aware that it's going on. It's just the lawyers doing things back and forth. But to start the process, the plaintiff has to prepare the complaint. In many states, file it with the court. And certainly every place you have to serve it on the other side to start the process going. Generally the allegations of the complaint are kind of charitably construed. Courts will not throw it out on a technicality if you misspell the defendant's name, as long as they knew who it was. So the rules allow the complaint to be liberally amended. So if you discover some fact that you had a little bit wrong in the complaint, you will usually be allowed to amend the complaint to make sure that it complies with what really was going on. Well, at this point, okay, so the plaintiff starts the lawsuit. I told you the parties and their attorneys really control the whole process. What happens? So here the defendant has some choices, really. The first choice that the defendant has is, well, so I'm not going to do anything about it. I'm just going to throw this complaint away. I don't know what to do, or I can't find a lawyer to help me with this, or I just, I just decide to tear the thing up and throw it away and kind of hope for the best. So that's the first thing that might happen. In that case, what the plaintiff will probably do is go ahead and go to court and ask to have you held in default because you didn't answer within the period of time allowed. In most cases, it's 20 days. If you don't answer within those 20 days, you are in default. And then the follow-up procedure for that is to get a default judgment and have the court order judgment against you for X dollars because you never answered. So that's the first thing that might happen. You might look at it and say, well, wait a minute, this case is just totally improper. I'm going to go to court and make a motion to have the case dismissed. I'm going to go into court and ask the judge to throw out the case, a motion to dismiss. And there might be a number of grounds for that. One is I was not properly served with it. Yeah, I found out about this case going on. I just happened to hear about it, but I never got served with a copy of the summons and complaint. I might be a lack of jurisdiction. I might go into court and say, well, wait a minute, this court does not have subject matter jurisdiction over this kind of case. Or this court does not have personal jurisdiction over me because I'm a Wisconsin resident. I've never set foot in Minnesota. Why are you suing me in Minnesota? You don't have personal jurisdiction. I might move to dismiss for that reason. Or I might just read the complaint and say, well, wait a minute, yeah, I did all this stuff, but that there's no law against it. Back in the olden days, that used to be called a demurrer, but now it's called a failure to state a claim on which relief may be granted. Or we lawyers often call it a 12b6 motion because it's governed by Rule 12b6 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. And I think Minnesota, it's doesn't use letters, so it's 12-2-6 or something, but it's kind of called a 12b6 motion. So you go into court and say, judge, throw this case out for one of these or maybe some other reason. So that's one thing that might happen. Or the third option that that the defendant might take is file an answer. And what the answer is you go through and you admit, deny, or say, I don't know. To all the allegations. So yeah, I admit that I was driving along that day. Yeah, I admit that we got into an accident, but where you said that it was my fault, I deny that part. I deny that it was my fault. Or in some cases, you'll say, I don't know. So it's just kind of going through the complaint and saying, yeah, this part is true, but this part is not true, and raising any affirmative defenses. If I sue you for punching me, that's an assault. You come back and say, yeah, I punched you, but it was in self-defense. Well, that's an affirmative defense. You would put that in your answer. Again, three things that a defendant can do if they receive a summons complaint. They might do nothing, in which case there'll be a default judgment. Maybe that's the logical thing to do. Maybe this person doesn't have any money and doesn't really harm them. Or maybe they just were not able to get a lawyer to help them. So that's one thing that might happen, a default or a motion to dismiss. Or the third thing that might happen is an answer. And at this point, we'll give our second code number for this portion of the program, which is 4-213, 4-213, 4-213, 4-213 is our next code number for this part of the program. Okay, next the author talks a little bit about some kind of different aspects of litigation, like can there be multiple parties to a lawsuit? Well, sure there can. There might be more than one plaintiff. There might be more than one defendant. Because the general principle is we want the system to be as efficient as possible. So, if there are two defendants being sued for something that's a little bit related, well, it's best just to kind of consolidate that into one case. So, yeah, there can be multiple defendants, there can be multiple plaintiffs. There's a car accident, the driver and the passenger get injured. Well, they can both be suing the other driver. That's certainly possible. What if I sue one defendant, but they say, well, wait a minute. Yeah, maybe it was partially our fault, but it was really somebody else's fault. Can one defendant bring in another defendant? And yes, they can. And that's a process called impleader. Impleader. You implead another defendant. So if plaintiff is suing defendant one, defendant one might bring in defendant number two. Defendant one would implead defendant number two. You can have multiple claims in a case. You can have counterclaims. So a counterclaim just means that I am suing you for something, you get this complaint, and it's your lucky day. I went to the bother of commencing the lawsuit because you really wanted to sue me, so you bring a counterclaim against me. That's certainly possible, as long as it has really doesn't have to be a real strong connection to the original case. But if it's involving the same parties, in the interest of efficiency, the court is going to put it all together and say, sure, we can have this counterclaim. A cross-claim is once we have these two defendants in the case, maybe one of the defendants wants to sue the other defendant. So I sue both of you, but defendant one says, well, defendant number two is really mostly at fault, and on top of it, they owe us money. So we're asserting, since we're all here in the courthouse anyway, we're going to have defendant one versus defendant two, and that's called a cross claim. Another special kind of litigation is the class action. And as I mentioned, you can have multiple plaintiffs. If you get into a large group of people, maybe they all have a small amount of money. So, my bank ripped me off for 42 cents. So I'm going to go sue my bank for 42 cents. Well, that doesn't really make a lot of sense. It's just not worth it. But they stole the same 42 cents from another million people. That is kind of a big deal. So I can bring that lawsuit as a representative for the group, the other members of the class will be bound by that. And there are many conditions there. They have to be notified. The court has to have jurisdiction over those other plaintiffs before they get bound by the results, because maybe they wanted more than 42 cents. There's a pretty rigid set of rules governing class actions, which are certainly outside the scope of this thing. According to the text, the largest class action of all time, according to him anyway, or a large one, was 5 million merchants who were suing Visa and MasterCard. I take Visa and MasterCard on my website, so maybe I was a member of that class. So I was one of the 5 million plaintiffs, maybe, suing Visa and MasterCard for the way that their merchant fees were set up. If I was a member of that class, then I would have been bound by that judgment. I could not come in later and say, well, wait a minute, I want to sue Visa and MasterCard. And they'll say, well, no, you already got your check for 42 cents. Minus 42 cents attorney's fees, so you already benefited from that case. So there are opt-out provisions. So I could have opted out of that case if I was a member of the class. So that's why you occasionally see, ads in magazines saying, attention, this is a notice from the district court in so-and-so state for anybody who, bought this product. You're a member of this class action. If you want to opt out, write to this address. So anyway, class actions, that's a special case of multiple plaintiffs. So anyway, the case gets started. What happens next? Generally, it goes into the discovery phase. Now, you know, maybe 100 years ago, even discovery was not really very common. You know, you think of when we think of litigation, like most of you, I got much of my early legal training from watching Perry Mason on television, and they didn't have discovery in the trials that Perry Mason was in. It was gotcha litigation. At about 5 minutes before the program was over, somebody stood up in the back of the courtroom and confessed, it wasn't Perry Mason's client. Well, that doesn't happen so much anymore because of the discovery process, because both sides get to kind of see what evidence the other side has. So discovery is simply the process of getting information from the other side before trial. So you kind of know what the other side knows before trial. There are a number of mechanisms for discovery. First is the deposition, where somebody is called in to testify, just like they would be testifying in court. They'll be asked questions under oath. They're required to answer them, and a court reporter is there to take down the answers. That's a deposition. So, if I'm suing you over this car accident, you take my deposition and your lawyer asks me a lot of tough questions about what happened during the accident. Another method is interrogatories to a party. That's a set of written questions that there are answered. Some thought goes into them in the lawyer's office. Answering these written questions, telling the other side what you know about the case. And there are also document requests. You can request copies of any documents or other physical things in the other person's possession and be able to review those. So that's the discovery process in very, very short form. Next, other pretrial procedures. Many times there will be a motion for summary judgment, you would move for summary judgment. It's kind of like that motion to dismiss, but a little bit later in the proceeding, where it says, well, you know, after reviewing this discovery, Your Honor, here's what it looks like the other side is going to show in their facts, and there's really no material, genuine issue of material fact, because even if we take the other side's evidence, and construe it favorably, that kind of agrees with our theory of the case. And based upon the undisputed facts, we are entitled to judgment as a matter of law. So there could be a summary judgment motion that takes place. And then the other thing the author points out is that all of the pretrial procedures are generally kind of designed to encourage settlements. And in fact, now most courts will have some kind of a settlement conference built into the thing, because the judge doesn't want to have to preside over the trial, and the litigants really don't want to go to trial either in most cases. The idea of encouraging settlement is kind of written into many of the rules. At this point, I'm going to give our next code number for this portion of the program. That is 4-319. 4-319. 4-319 is our next code number for this portion of the program. Well, after all these pretrial procedures, we finally get to trial. And I think the author gave some statistics on how many cases actually go to trial. And it's a pretty minuscule number, because first you have that screening mechanism where people have to realize that they have a case, they have to find a lawyer, they have to decide that it's worth litigating, the case doesn't settle, the case doesn't get tossed out. It's a pretty minuscule percentage that actually goes to trial. And the author points out that the trial is maybe one of the things that the TV shows actually kind of get right. So you kind of know what the procedures are for a trial. First of all, a jury is selected. The jurors are asked questions in a process called voir dire. And I knew one attorney. I was always, I was a young attorney. He was a very senior attorney, and I never wanted to point this out to him because he kept saying voir dire. He pronounced it just how it was spelled. That's not how it's pronounced. It's not voir dire. It's voir dire, where you see what the members of the jury have to say. So it's a process of being able to question juries during voir dire. Ask them for any things that you think they might not be a good juror, and then you can if somebody has something really bad, saying I hate your client, I would never rule in their favor. Well, then you can have them removed from the jury panel for cause. You say, Your Honor, we ask that juror number seven be we respectfully ask that he be excused for cause. And also, you have a certain number of peremptory challenges. If you just have a hunch about this guy, you can select that person. So then ultimately, a jury is selected of either 12 people historically, or now a lot of times 6 people in a civil case. Then you have the opening statements. They're not called opening arguments. They're called opening statements because you're not supposed to make arguments then. You're just supposed to tell the jury what the case is about, what you anticipate the facts will be. The plaintiff goes first because the plaintiff has the burden of proof. And the burden of proof means that the plaintiff has to prove their case by a preponderance of the evidence. And when we get to criminal cases, we'll talk about a different burden of proof, the proof beyond a reasonable doubt. But in a civil case, generally, the plaintiff has to prove the case by a preponderance of the evidence. It's more likely than not that the plaintiff's side is right. And then the defendant can make an opening statement. Sometimes that's done right away, or sometimes at the beginning of their case. And then the plaintiff presents their evidence. The plaintiff, and that's usually by witnesses testifying, or by physical exhibits. But those physical exhibits are generally introduced through by means of witness testimony. The plaintiff presents their evidence. The defendant presents their evidence. If the plaintiff wants to rebut something that came up in the plaintiff's case, they will go. Then there will be closing statements, which are properly called closing arguments. And then the judge gives jury instructions. So the judge says, well, here in an auto accident case, it all boils down to, was the defendant using due care? And the judge will explain what due care means and what negligence means and say something to the effect of, if you find that the defendant was negligent, then you must, award your judgment. So the jury becomes the fact finders, but those jury instructions are an admonition of what the law is. So the judge says you have to apply this law based upon the facts that you find. As I mentioned, evidence is presented during this process, and in general, that is testimony. The lawyer asks questions of witnesses. The witnesses answer those questions. In general, all of those witnesses are fact witnesses. They tell what the facts are. If they're, and the lawyer asks me, what happened? Well, I was driving along, minding my own business. There'll probably be an objection when I get to the minding my own business part, because that's not a fact. So I was driving along northbound on this street, and out of nowhere, this car came and crashed into me on the side. I tell what the facts are. The exception to that, the only people who are not restricted to testifying to the facts are expert witnesses, because expert witnesses, an expert in accident reconstruction, perhaps, or mechanical engineering, saying the gas tank was defective on the car or whatever, those expert witnesses, experts in some field that it is outside the domain of what the average person on the street would know, expert witnesses testify as to their opinion. So in my opinion, The gas tank was defective because it was mounted this way, and it was dangerous for that reason, in my learned opinion as a car designer. So expert witnesses give their opinions, but fact witnesses give just the facts. Evan, and now you also took a one semester course in law school on evidence. I'm gonna tell you the law of evidence here in about 5 minutes. All of that testimony, all of the evidence that comes into court has to be relevant. It has to have something to do with the case. It has to be calculated to make the thing that you're trying to prove a little bit more likely than it would have been otherwise. So you can't get off on tangents. All testimony has to be relevant. In general, hearsay is not allowed. Hearsay, spelled two words, hear, H-E-A-R, say, S-A-Y. You hear something and then you say it. Hearsay is repeating something that somebody else said. And in general, that's not allowed, although there are a million exceptions to the hearsay rule. But in general, you can't say what somebody else told you. Say, well, the police officer told me that the other car was speeding. Well, that's you're not allowed to say that. That's hearsay. If that fact is relevant to the case, well, then that police officer should come in and testify that the person was speeding. You repeating what somebody else said is hearsay, and that's not allowed. One particular class of evidence that's sometimes allowed is character evidence. If that some cases that might be an issue in the case, I don't think this person is telling the truth. In fact, so you have they have a bad reputation. So maybe character evidence might be allowed. Another subject that you spent a lot of time talking about in law school is privilege. Some testimony is privileged, and it's not allowed. So if I learn something because I'm an attorney and my client is telling me something, that information is privileged. And even though it might be very relevant, my client comes and tells me some information that might be extremely relevant in some litigation that they're involved in. Well, if I get subpoenaed and the court asks, what did your client tell you about this? I say, well, that's privileged. I can't talk about that. So again, that obviously we're just scratching the surface on that. We talked about juries a little bit. And you look in the Seventh Amendment, I think it's $10. It's a, that's one of our rights under the Constitution, that in civil cases, you have a right to a jury trial in cases of $10 or more, I think it is. So if you get sued for $9, I'm sorry, you don't get a jury trial for that. That's not one of our inalienable rights, but $10 you do. And what is a juror? As the author says, I think he was quoting somebody here, a juror is somebody who knows little about the law and nothing about the facts of the case. So that's who we have to decide our cases. But it re works remarkably well. Our legal system could be a lot worse. So even though we have these people you brought in off the street deciding these important issues. That's what a jury is. And again, they decide the facts and then they apply the law as instructed. The juror's job is just to figure out, just the facts, ma'am. Decide what facts happened in this case, and then based on those facts, the jury instructions that the judge gave them are what they are required to apply. Juries are supposed to be representative. They're supposed to be, representative of the larger community, and they're supposed to be impartial. And those are kind of constitutional issues because, again, the Seventh Amendment talks about it. So if you have a civil case and it's a the jury is not representative of the community and they are not impartial, well, that's a constitutional violation of the Seventh Amendment and probably of the state constitution. Before we wrap up, a few final things. I'm just going to give you our last code number for this portion of the program. And our last code number for this portion of the program is 4-489. 4-489. 4-489. Is the last code number for this portion of the program before we talk about two more minutes or so of other things. We talked about voir dire also along with the proper pronunciation. What can happen after trial? Well, there might be a directed verdict, there might be a directed verdict or a JNOV, a judgment notwithstanding the verdict. Abbreviated in Latin as JNOV. A directed verdict says, both of those are similar to a summary judgment. You're saying basically, even if all the facts are, as the other side put it, we win, and there's no way that the jury could rule against us. So if you feel that way before the jury has deliberated, you say, Judge, you know, this case was so strong, it should be tossed out. And shouldn't even go to the jury. That's a motion for a directed verdict. Or if the jury has already ruled and you say, well, you know what? They got it wrong because the facts were so strong. And if they had applied the law as Your Honor had told them to, there's no way they could have ruled the way they should have. So we're entitled to a JNOV, a judgment notwithstanding the verdict. Those are some of the post-trial procedures that might happen. Also, if you think something was wrong during the trial, you might make a motion for a new trial at that point. Finally, we'll just really quickly mention that what can happen after that? Well, an appeal. An appeal is basically to correct legal errors that happened below. And it generally has to be from a final judgment, though. So you can't, if you think the judge made some kind of grievous error, well, generally you have to wait until the case is over before you file an appeal. So if I lose the case in the district court, well, then I will appeal that to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. If I lose there, I might appeal to the Minnesota Supreme Court. If I lose there, I might appeal to the United States Supreme Court. So that's kind of the last thing that can happen in litigation would be an appeal. So thank you once again for joining us. We look forward to seeing you again when we get to Lesson 5. If you have any questions about this or any of my programs, please visit my website at richardclem.com. And again, I look forward to seeing you at the next part of this program.